Hey, everybody. We've got the season finale of the Higher Learning Podcast coming up right now. Before that, I want to thank everybody who has been part of the community and all of our wonderful guests in this past season. There's been so many highlights and so many great stories. I'm so excited for everybody who's been along on the journey. Now I've got really good news. We've got a season two coming up where we're going to have a new studio, new format, new guests. It's really going to be awesome. I cannot wait for you all to hear and listen in on all these amazing stories. So what we're going to do is over the next few weeks, we're going to get set up and I want to leave you with a best of season one episode that you can listen to. We're going to bring in people like Tania Rivers, Amelia Serdell, Chris Forney, and so many others. Take a look, listen to some of the best moments and some of my favorite moments of this past season, and I hope you enjoy.
Absolutely. I think it's a great call out by you. So we talked about your career. I'm going to take a little bit on the personal side for a second before we get into hiring questions. Well, you worked at the 76ers. You worked with the NBA for a while. It looks like you worked with I'm missing it. It's the ownership of the 76ers. They had multiple teams, correct? Or
So you're talking about the umbrella company, which is HBSC, yes. Also known as Harris Blitzer Sports Entertainment. So they have properties under that umbrella, and that's the Philadelphia 76ers, the New Jersey Devils, the Prudential Center, which is arena in Newark, New Jersey, you know, NBA 2K. So there is some other teams. So definitely was a fun ride. You know, I love sports. I grew up watching football with my dad, watching the Eagles. Go Eagles. We're 5-0, by the way. For
you just beat my favorite team last week because my quarterback decided to slide in front of the first yard.
But the whole timeout thing. Yeah, I know.
Hey, listen, can I say something for Kyler Murray? The stadium put first and 10. Okay. So in the moment, I understand why it happened, but I got to tell you, I love Philly because whenever you land and you get downtown, all the arenas are right there. Right.
You can see them. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the name of the football stadium is now. It's not the Vet anymore.
The Lincoln Financial.
Yeah. Been there for a Cardinals game. I got to be honest. I wore a big jacket over my Cardinals shirt. But you know what? They were really polite, really nice. I think some of the stigma you hear about Philly sports fans.
Because that polite and nice can get a little.
Hey, I was also mindful of what I said and how loud I cheered. Okay, so I kept it calm. What is your favorite team of all? And then who's your favorite athlete in Philly sports history?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh my gosh, let me think about it.
So team wise, the one that you most want to win the championship.
Okay, so. Prior to, because I think for those of you who kind of know my story, know that I have a son that plays in the NBA, right? So prior to my son being in the NBA, back in the day when I, you know, growing up and watching sports with my father, I was a huge Philadelphia 76ers fan. And of course, changes.
Hold on. I gotta talk to my research team. Your son is in the NBA. Who's your son?
Mikal Bridges. He plays for the Phoenix Suns. He used to, he went to Villanova. He had two national championships.
You want to know something? Can I talk to you about something real quick? I got to hold back.
Okay.
I'm a diehard Phoenix Suns fan. Diehard. Okay. I was going to ask you if you worked with Mikal Bridges' mom, because I'm very familiar with the story of how he was drafted by the 76ers, put on the hat, Mikal Bridges is your son?
Yeah. That's
true. Whoa. Wow. See, we got to talk about hiring now. I got to take a deep breath. Humongous Sun fan. I was at game 6 2 years ago in Milwaukee. That's how big a fan I am.
Oh, I was there too. Got COVID. But that's a whole nother story. It was so many.
We got to talk later. We're going to have an awesome offline conversation. Wow.
Okay. But go Sun. So Allen Iverson was one of my favorite players.
Yep.
Because he's gritty, you know. He was very talented, but that grit that you look for, and very scrappy. And I loved AI, but no doubt right now, my favorite player is Mikal Bridges.
Second in defensive player of the year. He's got that 3-D game. There's more to his game than just 3-D, though. I'm expecting a big jump from him this year, and Ayton and Cam Johnson.
Points up. That's right.
Yeah,
be aggressive and. You can share, but you can drive too.
I love it.
Little tips for mommy.
Well, you just won the award for podcast guest of the year. I'm so happy.
Oh, yay!
So I guess we got to talk about hiring, which I'm really excited to talk about. So let's move into that. You've been involved in hundreds, if not thousands of hires throughout your career, I'm sure. Can you tell me if you have an overall interviewing or hiring philosophy?
Look, I think is that we're sometimes hyper-focused on really trying to understand, like, if this person is going to be a good fit for whatever the organization that we're interviewing for, and we're prepared. And, you know, so we just have to kind of take a step back and remember you were once a candidate. It can be very daunting. Not every single person is going to be great at interviewing. And how can you really make it a more comfortable environment so that it's just a conversation? It's just two people talking about a position, and we're trying to ascertain if this is going to be a good fit for the company, and this is going to be a good fit for the individual who's applying for the job. So I think that as interviewers, we just have to remember that they are humans, and you were once on the other side of the fence interviewing yourself. And let's try to be easy. You know, I'll tell you this, Oz, is that I hired someone before in the past, interviewed terribly. I felt bad because the person was just so nervous. You can hear the shaking in a person's voice. It was an in-person interview. Person was like, the hands were shaking. And I said, it's okay. Take a deep breath. I said, this is just two friends having a conversation. I'm trying to figure out what you are passionate about so I can make sure that I set you up for success. And, you know, the person did calm down a little bit, but I had other people that by far practiced and was the best interviewers ever. And guess what? I hired that person who maybe did not interview well, maybe had a hard time articulating their thoughts, but I can understand where that person was coming from. I saw the positions and the work and the accolades that person was able to do at prior organizations, hire that person to date. That person was one of the best hires that I've ever had before. So I say to you interviewers who are listening here is that you have to be creative. You have to figure out a way to tap into that candidate so you can understand their story and understand where they're coming from and what they can bring to the table, and not just be this person who's like, they're taking a test. It's not an exam. It's a conversation. And we have to be very mindful of that.
Giving the candidate the agency to interview you, because you're right. It's about mutual relationships. So I think that's awesome. One of the other things that I've noticed in terms of kind of your social presence of your company at MSH is that a big, maybe unintended factor, maybe intentional factor, is how people get a sense of what it's like to work at your company through those posts. Is that intentional for you? We get a lot of comments about people saying, you know, I want to do some research on your company, started seeing some of the things that you're posting about, seems like a great place to work, and that's why we came here. Is that same thing happening for you in Cloud? And is that an intentional part of the strategy?
Absolutely. So my strategy with my personal brand and also building the culture of personal branding within the business is, A, we're a personal branding agency. So no one's going to trust us to build their personal brand if we're not building ours, right? Like, that's the number one. It's credibility.
Sure.
The second thing is it drives inbound leads. Like, you know, people buy from people. My team have got 500 times more reach on their individual profiles than my company page ever would. Although we invest heavily in the company brand and company socials and company marketing, I also invest heavily in the personal branding because I think you need both. And then the third thing is employer branding, right? Like, it's a real struggle to hire good people, not because it's a struggle to hire people. Like, this whole thing of like, there's a war on talent. I'm like, there is always a war on talent, because if it was a job you needed doing, it wouldn't matter who did it. You'd be able to find someone who fit your budget. You'd be able to find someone who did the skills, and you'd be able to find someone who met your values. But the struggle is trying to find someone who can do all three is impossible. And it doesn't matter when you're hiring. It could have been 1952 or 2035. You're still going to have the same freaking problem. There's always that element to it. It's like, how can we peer people behind the curtain of clout? Because obviously I'm biased, right? I was like, I think I've built this incredible culture because it's mine. But my team talk about it as well. They're like, that is what makes this special. Like, I'm friends with my employees, and like, you actually give a shit about me. And so it's almost using the personal brands of the employees to get that message out there so that we are ready to hire. We have a pipeline of people, and it's worked, right? Like, we've hired people, the last couple of people we've hired have come through that network, have come through, oh, I saw Megan post this, and oh, I saw such and such post that. And actually, ironically, the third highest search involving me and Clout is Clout Jobs. So it's like Amelia Sordell, and then it's like Clout Agency, and then it's Clout Jobs. It's like nothing else. Yeah. It's like, so I think that is synonymous with the fact that my team is so good at presenting Clout as a great employer. And we do that basically by just asking them to post once a week about the business and like why they like it and shout out their colleagues and like talk about things we're doing. And they like that because then it gives a strategy for them to post content and one less post that they have to worry about each week.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir here. Our leadership styles are very, very similar. I think somebody said that you're the female version of me, or I'm the male version of you.
Yeah, one of my teams said that. They're like, you're just like a female version of us.
I love that. It's so important, right? And one of the things that's tough is, and I don't know if you've struggled with this too, but being a friend, right, doesn't mean that you can't hold people accountable. Doesn't mean that you can't be a great leader, right? And that's something that I think a lot of people kind of either one way or the other, they kind of mix up. And to me, at least with my direct reports, knowing about their personal lives, what's going on in their personal lives, their families, their struggles, their motivations, makes me a better manager and leader. And for so long, I think people wanted to kind of decouple that and say, listen, I'm going to stay away from that. And I think that makes you a less effective leader. And you also have to be able to kind of adapt your style based on people's preferences, the way they receive validation, the way they receive coaching, all that good stuff. So I think it's really smart on your part to have that. And to that point, I've seen you post before about work is not a family, right? So can you give me a little bit, can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, to your point, yeah, let's be friends because we all know we collaborate better and we're more creative and we're more innovative and we do better work when we enjoy who we're working with, right? Like that's a fact. We know that to be fact. However, I find this concept of we're a family like really toxic because normally when people say a company is a family, they're not like they're the total opposite of that. It's almost projecting. Like a cover up. Yeah. It's like a mask that companies wear when they haven't actually worked on their culture properly. And there's probably a couple of people kicking around who've been there since it was founded, maybe their family, because when things go wrong, they shut down ranks and protect each other. But everyone else is kind of on the outskirts. And I also think this idea of where a family brings people into this sort of false sense of security because families aren't remunerated based on their performance or fired because they don't meet it or pulled up on stuff because, you know, something went wrong and they need to learn from that mistake. Families are unconditional for the most part. Employment is conditional on everyone pulling their weight, whether it be the employer, because the candidate might leave, or the candidate, the employer might fire you. That's a conditional contract. Your family is not a conditional contract, it's an unconditional contract. So telling people we're part of a family kind of creates this sort of false sense of like, oh, we're a family, so we look after each other. Sorry, if you keep it up, we're not going to look after you. It's just like how this works, right?
Yeah.
I just really don't like this concept.
I love to talk about hiring, so I want to jump into it. I want to learn a little. You've obviously hired hundreds of people throughout your career. You've been in part of large enterprise organizations. Hiring has to have been a big part of your success. So let's dive in. I want to know a little bit. Let's start here. Do you have an overall hiring philosophy that you adhere to whenever you're bringing somebody onto your team?
I do. And it's pretty simple, really. I'm always looking for what I term as athletes. And, you know, that resonates for me because I guess I was an athlete. But at the same time, I think it's really about, you know, that versatility. And I'm looking for talent with that has the intangibles. You know, what are their intangibles? And what I also refer to that as kind of what is your superpower? What's your differentiator? How, you know, what differentiates you from other candidates? And so, you know, for me, that really drills into the how of a person. I mean, the what you can see on a resume, right? What have they done up to this point? Where did they get their degree, et cetera, et cetera? But the how is so important. And, you know, I'm always looking for athletes. And, you know, back to, you know, the comment that I made about getting thrown into a position where you might not know, you know, what you're doing, or you might not, an athlete can handle that, right?
Yep.
They've got some experiences that they can draw upon, you know, maybe they're, you know, they've been through, they just can weather the storm, you know,
sure.
they can get knocked down a couple times and get back up and be like, I'm ready. Like I learned I'm ready. And so I just think that, you know, it's really about, it's just really about that what are the intangibles? And
sure. And
those are, you know, that's going to blossom into leadership one day. And that's going to blossom into, you know, they just have that drive and that you can see it when you talk to folks. I mean,
discipline, drive.
Absolutely.
And listen, like with athletes, like
they've never been in the postseason before, but they know how to perform when they get there because of experience. They never maybe taken the last free throws in a championship game, but they've been in enough experiences where they can apply it, right? They don't have to go through it every time to be able to be good at it. So I think that's a great, great, great mindset. Let me ask you, in terms of memorable interviews you've ever had, good, bad, you don't have to name any names, but maybe you were interviewing or maybe you were interviewing somebody else. Tell me something memorable that comes to mind.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, my most memorable interview as a candidate was, you know, I could just tell from the very get-go that, you know, everything clicked. I could tell that, you know, the interviewer, the leader that was looking to hire me was looking for someone that had my intangibles and or what I believe to be my superpower. And, you know, I felt like, you know, their values were in line. I just got a super positive vibe and I knew that, you know, things clicked right from the start. So you can just kind of get that feel for, I can see myself here. I can see myself working every day with this individual. And you know, that's probably the best, you know, interview that I've had, the vision, the fit, you just know it's right. And I think that was probably the most positive experience. As an interviewer, I have a really memorable day back early in my career. So I was probably, oh gosh, I was a director. I think I was hiring for, you know, a couple direct from campus, you know, direct college grads. And they came in, two of them, and they were in, you know, different interviews, but same day, they were very different individuals. One was just, you know, full of energy and very extroverted. One was extremely introverted, but he got it. You could just tell he got it. And so, you know, those two individuals came in and they were hungry. Their why was they wanted their first job. They wanted their first shot and they didn't have a job, but they showed a lot of drive in their own sort of way. One was like really outgoing and I could tell he had drive. The other was really thoughtful, really, but I could tell just from the way he describes some of the things that he, you know, how he approached certain things, that he had that drive. He had that, what I call fire in the belly. And I could just tell that they were, you know, they were going to be learners, you know, from day one. And so the rest was history, right? Brought him in, gave him an offer. And today, even today, I still keep up with those two. One's actually a CEO for a smaller CPG company.
Wow.
And one is a CFO at a company as well. So, you know, we keep in touch regularly. If I texted them right now, they'd be like, oh, hey, remember those times when we worked together? And, you know, you could just tell from day one that, so those were, you know, just positive interview story there.
Here's what stands out to me about that, right? A lot of people, right? A lot of times we're looking for mirroring when we're hiring. We want somebody like ourselves. And I give you a lot of credit for not just bucketing someone into the introvert, into the extrovert bucket. You looked at their why, you looked at their core, you looked at the commonality and you hired both of them and you had success with both of them. Whereas a lot of people might've leaned, this person's a little more gregarious. And so I really appreciate their, this person's a little more analytical and that's what I'm looking for. You were able to kind of drive the thread of greatness through both of them. And just so interesting that they both had tons of success. So I give you a ton of credit because most people look at those things very superficially. And so that's why you're here, because you're great.
You got to dig deep. You got to keep asking questions. Yep.
You got to get into the bog.
that's right.
Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in interviews?
I do.
Tell me.
So it's about the differentiator. I really want to know what it is that differentiates a candidate. So what do they think is, you know, what about them differentiates them? You know, and when they come back and say, well, you know, I've had supply chain experience and I've had, you know, brand finance experience and I've done sales finance, I'm kind of like, okay, that's interesting.
Sure.
When they start talking about, I'm a great communicator, or I'm really good at building relationships, or I'm really analytical and I'm able to tell the story. I can work in the weeds and raise it up and go into a boardroom and tell the story. You know, I can relate to, you know, to the business, or, you know, it can be a number of things. I mean, everybody's differentiator is different. And, you know, so I'm really looking to hear what their superpower is. You know, most people, and the other thing that it shares is how self-aware are they? Mm. Do they know what they're really good at? And if they know what they're really good at, well, then how do we get that and make that just blossom? People are so fixated on what am I working on, or what are you really terrible at? Which, you know, we all have to work on things, but the reality is, you know, the 90% of you is what you're really great at. So how, let's be awesome at that and let's understand what that is and let's see how, you know, that can be beneficial to our team.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what's cool is if you interview a bunch of people and you find out what their differentiators are and they're also very different, then you've got this, you know, this real, you know, you've got something really, really special because you've got, you know, you don't have everyone looking the same. They're bringing something different to the table. And then that kind of elevates everybody's game. So that's what I like to ask. And that's kind of what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I've said throughout my career personally for myself and people that have worked for me that, you know, there's always this thoughts about working on what you're not good at or your liabilities. And I've looked at it a different way. I've always thought, whatever your special powers are, you've got to lean into that and accentuate that. And then just make sure the things you're not great at don't become liabilities. Just get them to a certain level where they don't become your story. And then where people can really focus on what you're amazing at. Because trying to be great at everything, there's not enough time in the day. It's an impossible function. And then what's the point of having a team around you that can complement your skills? Lean in to what makes you great. And I think that's a really smart thing on your part, because I think if we get too focused on what we're not good at, then we start to dull what makes us special. The other thing I'll say, and I don't want to give away any of the secret sauce, but if you're going to interview with Chris and she asks you what your differentiator is,
you better know.
I think grit would be an amazing answer.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that'll stand out. All right. Well, listen, we just gave it away. We'll know who listened to the podcast based on your interview.
Some things like having a kid,
same thing.
Have a kid. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't tell anybody about it. You're going to have to experience it yourself. You're going to have to change those diapers at 3 a.m. yourself and not get any sleep.
Going back to you asked me, like, when I look at investments and, you know, people, like, the things I'm looking for, like, how do they deal with adversity? Like, if, you know, if you've been an athlete and you've had, you know, and you've lost a bunch and you've won a bunch and then you've lost it, like, how do you deal with that stuff? What are the things in your life that you've not necessarily been successful in? How have you persevered through that time? Right. If you've had a divorce in your life, like how did you bounce back from that? Like, you know, whatever the things are, if you experience loss in some other way. So I think that that's really critical to, you know, you said stomach, but like, how can you persevere through hard times? Because they are inevitable.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. The other thing, so I look at is, how do you handle things when they're great and they're at the tippy top and you're feeling really good? Right. And then how do you handle things when they're at the bottom? And that's your character ultimately in the day, because it's easy to handle things when it's even like this, but when you're having great success, you're going to reveal yourself. And when you're having great challenge, you're going to reveal yourself. And it's not easy to figure this out during an interview. That's certainly not the case, but those are the people that when I find out and I see those people in those moments and how they handle themselves, those are the ones that I know are keepers long-term. And the other thing I got to tell you is, you know, I figured you were on another podcast earlier. Now I'm feeling really competitive. I got to set the bar here. I feel like I got to button up. I got to really close this out strong. I'm just kidding. So I want to ask you a little bit, we're going to get off the hiring a little bit. I want to ask you a little bit about a day in the life of what your job looks like. And I'm interested to ask you both when you're going through a program and then maybe when you're not leading a program.
Yeah. So I can give you a day in the life of both. And also, like, there are very, very few days that look like, you know, maybe like at a macro level, they look similar, but like at a micro level, there are almost no two days that are the same.
Yep.
In program, it's really kind of like three pieces, three sections. The first section, when we're getting to know each other, I like to think of that as like the data section, which is we're trying to learn as much. And when I say we, I don't mean just the staff. I mean, the companies too. We're trying to learn as much as possible. So we're having lots of conversations. We're poking on everything. We're questioning everything. And we're trying to collect as much data as possible. And we do that a lot of different ways. The second part of it is taking that data and coming up with what we believe is a plan to move forward. And that could be anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months to 3 years. And there's no right or wrong answer there. It's just like, what are the data we have and what do we need to know? And how do we have a foundation so that we can continue to use some similar type of format going forward? And then the last piece is the execution and packaging of that plan. So that's a combination of actually starting to go do it. And if you're raising money or going to get customers or whatever it is, how do you have all the materials and things you need based on all the stuff we've done to date so that you can be successful doing that? And there's no, like, you know,
Great question. I'm going to double up on your know yourself. I spent my 20s doing that and just putting myself in a lot of different situations and asking myself, why do I feel this way? Why do I like this person? Why does this class stimulate me? And it gave me so much more sense when I got into the workforce, when I met my wife. So I 100% agree with you. Know thyself is the most important thing. And you have to be intentional about it. That is very key. Mm-hmm. So when you ask me, we're going to get deep here. When you ask me about ambition or legacy, it's definitely legacy. And I'll tell you why. I was raised, so I'm half Indian, half German. My parents could not be more different people. I don't even know how these two people met, let alone got married and had a kid. My dad is very far one side, liberal, earring in the ear, like dating, drinking, doing all these different things. And my mom could not be more conservative, comes from a religious background, very honor-based Indian upbringing. So I got, I'd like to think, the best of these two worlds. The thing that really resonates with me was that my mom always raised me in a way where I wasn't just behaving or making decisions for myself. It was always my family tied to that. And not many people know this about me, but my great-grandfather, he was essentially what I would call the vice president of a city state in India back in the early 30s and 40s in Hyderabad. And so in some ways that was considered, you know, royalty, right? For my family. And they grew up in a way that was extremely affluent and where there was a lot of privilege, but also a lot of things that came with having somebody of that level of stature in. And then of course, different things happened in terms of moving to the US, but legacy was always really, really important to me. And what's interesting is that I always felt no matter what I do on this planet, right? I've raised my children to be very in tune with our family unit and our last name and what that means, wearing that on your back or whatever, writing it on a piece of paper. That's why we do right or wrong in my family. And for that reason, having a son was really important to me. So much so that I had my first daughter, and then I had my second daughter, and I had my third daughter. And at my third daughter, my wife was in tears after we came back and found out the sex of the baby, because she knew that for me, having my legacy carry on was really important. And here's the other thing. I'm the only person with my last name. So long story, my mom and dad got married. They changed my dad's name. And so I am the only Rashid that exists from this line of family. Oh. And so that idea of legacy became even more important, because for me, if it just left without me, right, and I passed on, that would have been it. Or I could be the beginning of something, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting question. I don't think it's tied to ego. Maybe it is tied a little bit to ego, but a big part of it is that I want to leave this world better off than when before I came into it, right? That's why impact motivates me so much. And that's why my children are so important to me in terms of leaving that legacy. So legacy, long answer, most important to me. Ambition is cost of admission for doing what I do as an entrepreneur, but legacy is more important to me.
We have a very similar story, believe it or not, and I'll get it to in a second. But I got to know, did you ever have just ambition?
So I want to ask you, I want to throw it back to you. How do you differentiate between the two?
Ambition. Let me just get into my own story and then I'll define it for you.
Sure.
Just like your great grandpa, VP of state, city in India, affluent, privilege. My grandfather was a general in the Chinese army. He fought alongside the Flying Tigers in World War II.
Wow.
We lived in China very, very much in privilege. And my parents plucked us from that because my dad wanted to have a better life in America to make his own path. We came here with nothing. And so I got this in my head that I must make something of myself. And it really resonates me when you talk about with your son, because I was part of the one child law in China where we only have one kid.
Wow.
Mom tried a couple of times. It didn't work out three times. I was the fourth one. Had anything worked out prior to me, I wouldn't exist. So I had this chip on my shoulder that I have to make this work, or my parents' crazy dream of coming to America, this American experiment will fall apart and there's no backup plan. Mm. And all this will be for nothing. So you talk about legacy and a son to carry on your name. I'm a girl. I can't carry on my dad's name. Either I make it or there's nothing.
Wow.
So I came to America with this crazy notion that I have to make something out of me. And it drove me to this blind ambition. I didn't know myself very well in my 20s. And so when I was 20, I decided that the definition of success is one title. That's it. Didn't know there's fulfillment, didn't think about family, friends, nothing. It was one title. That was the definition of success. Doesn't make you happy, doesn't make you fulfilled, doesn't matter. And so I was blind with ambition. And what that looks like at the moment is my company's goals or my goals. I had no other goals outside of just that. And I wanted to get to the highest title that I can in the fastest time that I can. And I didn't think about what impact I was making in the world. You said you want to leave this world better off. You're motivated by impact. Your children mean something to you so much. I didn't have any of that. I just had a title that I was chasing. And so do you watch Game of Thrones?
I do.
Okay. Daenerys's story arc from when she was young and bushy-tailed at the end of season 8 when she's on a dragon burning down King's Landing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my ambition looked like. I could see myself starting in a certain way and then ending through lots of things that happened, burning down a city to make what I wanted come to life because I had no other definition of success. But to me, what legacy looks like, and I'm not there yet because I haven't accomplished what I wanted to yet. I'm really in the middle between ambition and legacy, is that you want to make a long lasting impact. There are people that you want to nurture. It's about the team, long-term objectives, sticking around when things get hard. Maybe it's longer-term wealth. Maybe it is your children, but it's about lasting impact than whatever I had going on before, which is I'm going to burn down the city as long as I get what I want.
I love that. And so I'm so glad you clarified that because as you said it, it crystallized in my mind why I wasn't leaning towards ambition. And it's because pretty early on, the way that people define success, money, title, you know, prestige, fame, I never looked at those as the things that I was looking for. I want to start here. Before we get into the EC, before we get into your journey, I want to know what is so important to you about community. And I'm actually interested to know, what's the first community you were in that mattered to you?
Yeah, community matters because we as humans, number one, we are just biologically hardwired for it. So we are social animals by nature. Our earliest ancestors, that is why they came together, to form community for a couple of reasons. Number one, just to survive because they realized, hey, I can't fight the saber-toothed tiger alone. I need your help. So let's get together. So number one, we as humans come together for safety in community, which means if you're trying to grow a community and it's not a safe space for those you're trying to attract, then we got to start there. We as humans, number two, once we feel safe, then we want to grow. We learn together. We go to school together. I know math, you know Spanish. Let's teach each other what we know. But number three, what sets us apart, you know, a lot of other species in the animal kingdom band together to survive and to grow. But number three, we find meaning in community. And so we are some of the only, or if not the only species that has to wonder, like, what is all this for? And so we come together, religion, philosophy, whatever we want to talk about, wherever it is we find meaning, we do that together. And I think entrepreneurship and starting a business can be one of those things that takes other people to have success. My earliest community that I think of course, it's going to be my home. I get it. Not everybody can find a community in their home. My hope for those folks is they can find a home in their community. So for me, I was very fortunate, had very loving parents, a great ecosystem at home that still supports me to this day as that family has grown. But I also remember things, a lot of us have this, whether it's early sporting teams, my church youth group growing up was very important, friends at school. So all of those, I always throughout my life, as I look back, I find this thread of community is woven throughout that kind of pieces a lot of things together and has gotten me to where I am today.
I love that. That's amazing. I'm reading a book called The Rational Optimist. And to your point, it was talking about kind of early man and what really differentiates us from other animals, right? Even animals with complex brains and different things like that. And really what they said was, what the author said was that no other being but a human actually barters back and forth in terms of I have fish, you have meat, let's trade. Other species like give things up, right? But there's this expected, nothing is about barter. And so I think that's really interesting to say that because as our world becomes more globally connected and we come together as a community, and our community actually gets much smaller and our ability to expand our community into areas that previously unseen, I just think it's so important that that coming together, it's really baked into who we are, who we were in the earliest of dawn of time. And so I think that's a really interesting perspective. Another thing you said that really stood out to me was you mentioned that the height of my success equals the depth of my community. That was really profound, but I'd like to get your point of view on that. What did you mean when you said that?
Yeah, before I came to the EC, I was an entrepreneur for 17 years, started 4 different companies, 2 in the product space, 2 in the consultancy space. And I was running my most recent company, which was a gift company, up until COVID hit. And when COVID hit, we had a retail store that was doing really well for us, had to close that down, pivot everything to our bulk sales and our online sales. And while there was opportunity in that, it wasn't easy. And obviously COVID upended the world in a way that is really unprecedented in most of our lifetimes. And I was exhausted about a year and a half, 18 months in. And I was exhausted. Yeah, I worked a lot because when you don't have to commute necessarily, or you can work all the time, you tend to work all the time as an entrepreneur. But when I really started diving deeper, I was like, I don't think I'm tired because I'm working hard. I've always worked hard. I was tired because I didn't have the opportunity to create and go deep in community. And so, yeah, that phrase about the end of 2021, about a year and a half into the pandemic, hit me. The height of my success is directly related to the depth of my community. And it was the serendipitous community that I was missing, that I thrived on. And so I was drained. It was the friends you might bump into at an airport. It was meeting a new person at a coffee shop. It was getting a mutual connection and saying, yeah, let's do lunch. You just couldn't do that for so long. And I was drained. And so as the world started to sort of emerge from a lot of the lockdowns and restrictions, a lot of that loneliness, I made it my personal mission to say, how can I help people understand the value of community? How can I get more of that into my company? And now how can I bring that to the EC to help especially entrepreneurs realize you're not meant to do this alone. You cannot do this alone. And so if you want to climb higher mountains, you need to first go deeper and assemble those people around you, be it a group of supporters, advisors, mentors, people who want to help you get to ever new heights of
success. Very soon. I want to ask you, obviously parenting is a big part of who you are. It usually is with any parent. We're going to talk about hiring philosophy because that's what this pod's about, but I want to know about parenting philosophy. Do you have any advice you can share with us in terms of you have kids at a very formative age that have really kind of guided you throughout this process?
You know, the easiest thing that I can, there's two ways I think about it. First, be honest with your kids. Whatever's on your mind, if you're irritated with them, if you're having a bad day at work, if you know the stuff's just not going right, tell them that. And then my advice to my kids from when they were really little, and I'm divorced, so these are not my kids with my current wife. So there's a whole set of complexities that go with that. Sure. And what I said to my kids is there's only 3 things that I'm going to teach you as your father. And really, I think any parent. And those 3 things are really simple. Be respectful to adults. Be honest and always do your best. If you can just do those 3 things, I'm not going to be a great math teacher for you. I'm probably only going to be a mediocre one, and probably the same with geography and all that other stuff too. But if you can stick to those 3 principles, we have half a chance of making you and us have a good life and you becoming a productive adult.
I love that. I'm going to write that down. And since we're sharing here, I'm going to share one of my parenting philosophies and something that's really, please, I think, helped me throughout this. So this journey that I've been on for 11 years with 4 children now, one of the things that I've always tried to do is I've always tried to make it much like you do with a company and a culture, somewhat tribal, right? That we're a group, right, that there's unity there and there's sacrifice that comes with that. And so everything that we do as a family is around being part of the Rashid family, right? Yeah. We are the Rashid family. Your name is important because it's my name. We're all in this together. And when they come and they say, and these are our guiding principles, right? We're not overly religious. It's not really about law for us. It's really about, we know what right and wrong is, and that is our standard, and that's what our family lives by. And so even if Jimmy down the street is doing something differently, or your friend has this and you don't, that doesn't matter because we're Rashid. And sometimes I even tell my kids, do you want to go be a Smith? You can go be a Smith. But if you want to be Rashid, this is what we do here. And those are the guiding principles that I think forms a real unity and a real clan. And so like we even had t-shirts, man, I mean, really cheesy, proud to be Rashids, things like that. But you're trying to create a tribe because quite frankly, that's what you have with your family. And if you can count on each other and be connected and have this idea of what good looks like, I think that can be a really powerful thing. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And by the way, I don't think it's limited to your family. I think it extends to the workplace. When, you know, we're going to get here and I'm kind of jumping the gun, but when I thought about Village MD, when we thought about culture, you know, just to be candid, we had a no asshole rule. And by that, I meant if the person was the most qualified on paper and they showed up really well, but you knew that they just had an edge and they weren't really going to fit, they would twist the company culture, then we probably don't want them. We probably don't want to hire them. So I think this whole notion that you threw out there about clan, I think it's so important for families. And I think if your kids actually get it the way you described it, they should be really proud of it. Wearing that t-shirt should be a badge of honor for them.
Leverage our data. And you know what? It always comes down to people, making sure that you have the right talent in place to give those insights. So I love that answer. You have had an absolutely incredible career journey. So you grew up in Jersey and then you moved to Silicon Valley. You worked at companies like Google, Microsoft, Open Door, Zenefits, among many others. How did all these experiences, because like you said, you worked big, small, you worked all across the board, insurgents, incumbents, different industries. How did being in all those different environments shape you to be a successful entrepreneur like you are?
Well, I'll wait on the title of successful entrepreneur until that's more official than it is today. That said, I'm really, you know, proud of my own personal entrepreneurial journey. You know, today I run Mozart Data, and I founded that company about 4 years ago with a very close friend and a former co-founder from a hot sauce company that he and I started together a little over 10 years ago. So we've had a few entrepreneurial journeys together, but throughout sort of my career, there's been sort of little entrepreneurial one-offs, which is to say, there's sort of always that grind or excitement for figuring out something that's missing in the world and figuring out a way that you can both add and capture some value. The way that sort of these companies in the past have like contributed to, you know, Mozart today is that they represent a lot of the questions that we're trying to answer at Mozart. So different companies, different contexts, different sizes, different industries, B2B, B2C, all of these things sort of have one thing in common, which is often they generated a lot of data. And, you know, again, they also, almost all the companies that I worked for had big appetites to try to find something useful in it and sort of move the company along. And when Dan and I started the company, myself as mostly a data analyst and Dan mostly as a backend engineer, decided to sort of bring our skills together to do sort of data engineering as a service in a product called Mozart Data. You know, the commonality was that we had great, what we call founder market fit. We had done this problem collectively, you know, almost a dozen times. And, you know, essentially these represented real problems that we were solving at these companies that we got to see firsthand in doing it. And that was sort of a cheat code, I think, to moving our business a little bit forward. So I think the toughest part of starting a business is really, you know, making something that people want. So there's sort of this YC cliche, make things people want. And one of the things that we were able to do was build for myself. So, you know, having built data teams at a number of different companies, but as you mentioned, in a number of different contexts, I really got to see the types of problems and the types of shortcuts these teams needed and where they ran into road bumps. And I thought that, you know, there had to be a better way than just constantly reinventing the wheel at every single stop. So at every single stop, you know, we would buy a bunch of services, we would hire a bunch of engineers to implement sort of a very similar stack and to sort of avoid some of the pitfalls. And we thought we could productize that.
I love that. And so it was just kind of a natural fit because you've been doing this before and you see there's an appetite in the market and you have the expertise and knowledge. And so it just became a no-brainer to start Mozart Data 4 years ago. And then
I wish it were a no-brainer. I think for many people, including myself, that sort of step off the ledge in terms of leaving a sort of a cushy or comfortable or job that you know or job that you're succeeding at is very, very, very difficult. And it was certainly for me.
Sure. And you had both been co-founders of Bacon Hot Sauce, is that correct?
That's correct.